This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Paula Poundstone does not live life scripted. She ad-libs on the wildly popular NPR quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and improvises her way through her stand-up comedy routines.
What do you do for a living, ma'am?
I'm an accountant.
You're an accountant? Really? So my story of being $1 million in debt must have made you chafe just slightly.
In addition to her live comedy, Paula is the author of the totally unscientific study of the search for human happiness. And she most recently is the host of the weekly podcast Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone. She's something of a political commentator on Twitter, where it matters. Paula Poundstone, welcome back to the State of Things.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here again. We're streaming live on Facebook, so you can watch this whole thing, and you can see you tonight at the Duke Energy Center for the Performing Arts in Raleigh. So that's why you're in town to do this. And I gather politics has your attention these days.
Oh, yeah, sadly. Although it's funny you said on Twitter where it matters. I think it doesn't matter at all on Twitter. Not at all.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I mean, it does and it doesn't, right? I mean, it's mindless. It's endless. But it also has 90% of our attention. So therefore,
yeah. Well, that's because any app is designed right. To do that. It's I wish I could say that it was changing, you know, hearts and minds politically and it was moving us forward. I don't think there's any evidence of that really. But I probably have an addictive personality. And I enjoy thinking of things that I think are funny and writing them down. And so I got caught up in doing Twitter and then I'll look at a news website and then I can't help myself but go because that's what I spend my life trying to articulate, like, you know, the meaning of life or understand who we are as America. I thought one day I had it. I thought for sure I had it because ever since Trump was elected or ever since he began campaigning, I've tried to figure out, you know, what's the matter with us. And I think it's this. I think that electing Trump is to Americans what beaching themselves is to whales. That's what I think.
See, it's just like, let me out of here. Yeah. It's just too much swimming. It's too hard.
No, like, scientists don't understand it. There is no rational explanation. No one has figured out why whales beach themselves.
Well, this is obviously, it is meaningful to you. You write a book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. This occupies your attention.
That did occupy my attention. My book is a series of experiments doing things that I or other people thought would make me happy. And every chapter is written as an experiment with the hypothesis and the conditions and the variables and the qualitative and quantitative observations, etc. But for me, the question wasn't what would I enjoy doing. I have a handle on what I enjoy doing. The question was, what could I do that would leave me with a bounce so that when I returned to my regular life, which at the time was raising a house full of kids and animals and being a stand-up comic and just being stuck being me 24 hours a day. So when I returned to my regular life, what could I do that would, you know, where I would feel good, it would buoy me up. I'll give you an example. The first experiment in the book is the Get Fit experiment, which seemed like kind of a no-brainer, really, right? Like, we've always been told that exercising makes you feel better. So I signed up for Taekwondo self-defense classes with this guy with a gym about 6 blocks away from me. Not because I have a passion for Taekwondo or self-defense, but because it was the closest gym to my house. And I wanted to get fit, but I didn't want to have to walk that far to do it. But I went to as many classes as many classes as I could on the days that I was not on the road. And they were grueling workouts. And I would go to the workout, and then I would come home and sit with my notebook and take notes and write, like, about what was happening in my regular life and about this workout. One day I'm doing it, and I start thinking to myself, I said, well, you know, gee, I'm paying this guy, you know, and it's not cheap. And I thought, what's to stop? Because I did recognize that I was feeling better in lots of ways. And I thought, okay, then knowing that, what's to stop me from just working out on my own. Because mostly what I do with them is calisthenics. You know, why don't I do some push-ups and some sit-ups and some jumping jacks here in my dwelling? And the following day, I go to the guy and he says to me, he says, do 500 rope jumps. I did 500 rope jumps. He says, do 100 sit-ups. I do 100 sit-ups. He said, do 50 push-ups. I did 50 push-ups. And then I collapsed on the mat. And he said, get up. And I thought, that's why I go to this guy. I would not. That's when you need the professional. I would not have thought of get up. It was the furthest thing from my mind right there. I was thinking cry or throw up. That's what I was thinking. And there, the professional.
Did it make you happy? Because you talked about, I mean, obviously the things that we search for that make us happiness and our addictions and our afflictions and all the things that we think are going to lead, and they only make us more miserable.
Yeah.
And then the things that make us miserable, we think might make us. So does the trichone, did it make you happy? Did the exercise, the workout, the fit body?
Working out does make you feel better. It just plain does. And I wish that wasn't true. I mean, my hope, you know, I had a bias going into it. My hope was that happiness had something to do with sitting in a chair and eating Doritos. That was my hope. But it
doesn't
does
always
not.
Work. Well, okay, but that brings us to the broccoli Twizzler paradox, right? The one you asked the question to your parents, we all did, how come the things that are good for me taste so bad and the things that are bad for me taste so good?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer. I mean, it's not like everything that feels awful is good for you. I mean, you can get run over by a truck and that's not good for you and it doesn't feel good. So there are some things that match up that way. I can't, you know.
But that's a sequel. That's a sequel to the Search for Happiness. Search for Happiness 2.
Yeah. No. Mm. Oh, there's many more experiments. Yeah. Many more experiments to be done. Let me think. What were some of the ones I did? One I did was, it was the Get Warm and Fuzzy experiment, I believe, where I decided to, I'd read a book by a guy who did a lot of hugging. And, you know, he had some scientific explanation of why that was good for us. And so I decided to hug everyone I met for 24 hours. And it was a day where I was traveling. And so right away, I mean, at the airport, I had to modify the experiment. Because, I'll tell you, the TSA does not like hugging. I was right away I'm on the National Do Not Hug list as a result. So I just changed, you know, I changed it to, you know, making some sort of you know, a handshake, a touch on the shoulder, that sort of, you know, that sort of thing. But there was a point at which after a show, I hugged 100, I think approximately 100 people in a row.
And?
Felt great. Felt fantastic.
There you go.
And I mean, I was in Boulder, Colorado. It was at the end of a taping of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It was at Red Rocks. It wasn't Boulder. It was Red Rocks. Mm-hmm. Outside on a beautiful night after doing a really fun show. So there were a lot of elements that made it feel good. But I would say that there was something to the connection of hugging.
Now, what's interesting about this is these experiments actually led you to volunteer with your dog, right, at nursing home?
My dog and I volunteered in a nursing home. My dog is serious. Yes. Originally, you know, again, it's not a new thought that, you know, volunteerism is sort of good for the heart. What I did was I really did pick sort of, you know, one of my worst fears, which I really was afraid of old people. And I don't have a good explanation for why. It's just the truth. I just felt afraid of old people. So I called up a nursing home. I asked if I could come volunteer. And it was one of the only experiments where I didn't quit after I started. Like with the Get Fit experiment, it took several months. But after I had the chapter, I stopped and I went on to the next variable. And my editor at the time didn't understand that at all. She kept going, well, the reader won't understand why you would stop if it was helpful. And I said, for science, because I'm isolating the variables.
There you go. Very good.
Jeez, that's that's the minimum one could do for science. But I did not. It was towards the end of the book. It was the second, maybe, I don't know, it was either the last or the second to last experiment I did. And I had what I needed from the volunteering at the nursing home experience after the maybe about 2 months, but I just felt like too much of a jerk to go, got what I need, see ya. So that was 3 years ago, and I'm still there. I do a lot of jigsaw puzzles, and I'm damn good at them now. It's funny because a lot of people say to me, like, I'll be doing a jigsaw puzzle with somebody, and they'll say, you're so good at this. Why are you so good at this? I said, well, because I've done this one several times. Eventually, there are clues.
May not remember doing this before, but I do.
But, you know, my goal really there, and it does, I go a couple mornings a week, and I'm only home a couple mornings a week. And so it's kind of valuable time for me. And there are definitely times where I wake up in the morning and I'm like, oh, I don't want to do this. And I can say, in the same way that you feel that about working out, I can say absolutely honestly that every single time I go, I get into it. Like, no matter how, you know, how reluctant I am, I go, I do it, and it does feel good every single time. That's a good question. Why, when there's something that we know from experience is going to make us feel good, do we still not? Why don't I jump up and rush to it the way if somebody said, you know, Butterfingers for breakfast, I would rush in. I love Butterfingers.
Exactly. When we cry in our grief, it is an amazing experience that gives everybody a sense of our common and shared humanity. And our resistance to tears and our resistance to feeling the depth of emotion is probably one of the greatest, one of the greatest barriers to humanity, to our own humanity. Like, we won't let ourselves cry. And if only we would. Every time we do it, we feel better. How come we don't do it every time?
I don't know. I just picture us being sort of miserable.
Well, we don't have to be in grief every moment, but
yeah,
I mean, when
I would
we're
like
in
to
no
not
grief.
Be.
Here's the but there's a converse to this, and you can because you've written the book, you can help me with this because there are good things we do that actually don't make us feel good. So,
yeah.
For instance, Christmas cards. I hate it. I hated it. I hated it. Hated it. December, and I would make deadlines. Hated it. And finally, I said, you know what? I'm not going to send them this year.
Oh, you stopped sending Christmas cards?
I just stopped sending them.
Oh, my gosh. And I thought I had been personally rejected.
No, I'm sorry.
And I realize
now.
I
thought I sent you the last card, the note. This
is
your last notice.
Yeah.
And I felt so relieved. And every year on that date that the first Saturday in December when I used to have to sit down, I just sit down and revel in the peace and the love and the glory that I feel, the happiness that I feel, and the relief.
So
that
at
I'm
the
not going to
at
write
the exclusion of doing something.
Yeah,
so
that is essentially good.
Wow.
It's a good thing, right? It's a good thing to send Christmas cards. I'm not, and I'm so happy.
It's a good enough thing, I guess.
Well, I mean, it's a sign of whatever community and bringing people together. This holly jolly time of year, and I say heck with it. I don't want to.
Yeah, I actually stopped buying a lot of Christmas presents a long time ago for the same. You know, I was buying for people who already had whatever they needed and didn't feel fun. And so I go shopping for Toys for Tots every year. And here's part of the sheer selfishness of that gesture, which is that when you buy for Toys for Tots, you are not selecting a gift for a particular person. They go to a distribution location, and then the parents come and choose from from the donations what's appropriate for their child or what they would like, whatever, right? And so it is a great fantasy as opposed to the stress of trying to find the thing that's going to make your friend or your kid happy. I get to just live the lie that whatever I choose did that.
Exactly.
And it's totally a lie. And then the parent who has to go to the distribution center and select, they have the pressure of matching, but for me, I just go buy the stuff I like.
It made somebody happy.
And I hope somebody picks it up for me and gives it to me.
Hey, talk about your podcast. That's relatively new for you.
It is new. Nobody listens to Paula Poundstone. It's me and my Adam Felber, who I met years ago doing Wait, Don't Tell Me. And we call it a comedy advice podcast. We bring on experts on various topics to, inform us. And it's mostly sort of, life topics, just stuff that would be helpful to know as you move forward in the world. But our number one job is to, is to be funny. And we're enjoying the heck out of it. I mean, the thing about podcasts, it's sort of radio without the responsibility or the self-discipline. Everyone has one now. One of the, we talk about bringing the country together and how we need to, we need to pay attention to our similarities and not our differences. Well, here's a great example. Right now in our country, one of the few things that we all have in common is that, we breathe oxygen, we don't eat our young, and we have a podcast. And so
it keeps
in
us all
this
together.
Way, it's
well, here's an example now with co-host Adam Felber. As you said, it's a call to Professor Joseph Horvath. And apparently this is 4:15 in the morning, and he is using your podcast to help teach English. Let's hear a sample of this.
I think you're a really good role model for real conversation.
Oh, there you go.
Of course, this course is about listening to each other and telling each other about interesting things. Like, I like the rapport between Adam and Paula a lot.
Oh.
I guess that's unscripted.
Mostly. It's mostly just me trying to get a word in.
Okay.
Is it unscripted? Is that what you...
Yeah, that's what, yeah.
No, there's a script. I often don't know what page we're on. they've written down some sort of touchstones.
Yeah.
Let me ask you something. How does comedy translate into Hungarian?
You don't mean linguistically. You mean culturally.
Yes.
It translates to my Hungarian.
There you go.
Are you a student?
That's from the podcast. Nobody listens to Paula Poundstone. Paula Poundstone is my guest, comic, author, podcast host, and also going to be at the Duke Energy Center for Performing Arts in Raleigh tonight.
Tonight?
You're going to be there.
Oh, my God.
Making funny. How much so scripted, unscripted? That's why. I knew I could throw you something crazy and you'd come back. And
the show I do on stage, there is no script. Somewhere in my head, I have 39 years of material, rattling around. I always figure that the inside of my brain must look something like that arcade game where you step into a glass, sort of a telephone booth-sized booth, and they blow paper money around, and whatever you can catch, you can keep. So I have 39 years of material rattling around, and I'm not sure when I grab something, where it's from, or when I wrote it, how germane it is to the moment. So I certainly have material, but I don't have a particular structure for that material. What I like to do, my favorite part of the night is I talk to the audience. I do the time honored. Where are you from? What do you do for a living? And people will get these little biographies of audience members emerge, and I use that from which to set my sails. So let me think of an example. If I were to say to somebody, what do you do for a living? And they said, oh, I'm a dance teacher. Well, I might well share with them a story about my own dance lessons. I might ask them further questions wherein I say things that I've never said before. Very similar to any conversation one has ever had in one's life.
Right.
When somebody says to me, hi, how are you? Or when I say to them, hi, how are you? One could say that was unscripted and improvised, but I've certainly said it before. So
have you grown more comfortable with that over time? I mean, I would guess early on you might be less comfortable letting go with some written material as time goes on. My guess would be you could be more comfortable. It's worked a lot.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things is in the beginning, I didn't think I should be doing that. Yeah. I mean, in the beginning, because what happened was I started in 79 in Boston, and this was when there was a renaissance in people's interest in the form of stand-up comedy. And so somebody else, not me, had started up had gone to a club and said, hey, how about if we have stand-up comedy here? And a little open mic circuit had become, which is the training ground for being a comic. And it became popular both with audiences and with people who wanted to do stand-up very, very quickly. And the premise of an open mic night is that anybody who wants to can go up for 5 minutes. And so there would be this long line of people who wanted to go on, I would have typed out my set and timed it and memorized it. And then I would go up on stage when it was my turn and promptly, out of nervousness, forget what I was going to say. And then I was stuck improvising.
Well, if you want to hear more of that improvisation, you're just going to have to go to the Duke Energy Center for Performing Arts in Raleigh tonight to see my guest, Paula Poundstone. Paula, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Check out our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a songwriting workshop in a women's prison helped inmates write their own music, and we're going to hear it next on The State of Things. Stay with us.